With that, we're going to go ahead and move into introductions. So like I said, each candidate will have 1 minute for their introductions, and we will be starting in order from the person closest to me, moving on down the tables. So, sir.
Thank you. Hey, thank you for coming tonight. My name is Dr. Al Olszewski, and for the record, it's not Olszewski, it's not Olszewski, it's not even Coach Krzyzewski, it's Albert Olszewski. Now, I'm currently a state legislator, state senator for District 6 around the Flathead Polson area. You know, as I grew up in Great Falls, I learned a very important lesson, and that is that you dance with the one who brought you. And my intent throughout this whole campaign was to dance with you, Montanans. And I've done that through the way that I've conducted my campaign and how I've collected campaign finances. So there's no strings attached. It's all about you. And tonight, I want to prove that. Thank you.
Good evening. It is great to see everyone here in Missoula. I am Matthew Rosendale. Many of you do know me. I am a rancher. I'm a businessman. I'm a former legislator, and right now I'm serving as your commissioner of securities and insurance. I serve the way that I campaign. I reduce spending. I reduce regulations. I fought for your property rights. I fought for your gun rights. I fought for the sanctity of life. These are the things that I promised to do, and these are the things that I did do. And because of that, I've earned the support of many people in this room, including our MC tonight, and Adam Hertz, and his dad over in Paulson, but also from folks as far as Culberson, where Speaker Knudsen has endorsed me, to Paulson, and up into the Libby area, and legislators across the entire state. We must beat John Tester. And if we are going to beat John Tester, we have to send a very prepared candidate to do so. And I am that candidate. Thank you very much for coming out tonight.
Sorry for missing your 10-second warning there. Sir.
Hi, I'm Troy Downing. First of all, where's Heather? Where's my wife? Stand up. Jeez. Stand up back there. My wife back here, I got to tell you, you can't do this without the support of your family, and I've been blessed, and I just want to point out Heather in the back there. Thank you. So I want to get right down to this. What's this about? This is about sending John Tester home. John Tester has not been good for Montana, has not been good for America, and we need to send him back to music class. I know he likes to take pictures on tractors, but we need to send him back to music class. There's a lot of great candidates up here, and as Republicans, you know, we share a lot of the same ideas, a lot of the same things about life, about liberty, about the Constitution. You find a lot of things that we have similar. But you need to decide who has what it takes to send John Tester home. I'm a businessman. I'm not a career politician. I'm the only one on the stage that isn't a present or past politician. I'm a combat veteran. I have built industries. I do international trade. I manufacture in the United States of America, and I ship all over the world. Troy Downing, thank you.
Good evening, my name is Russ Fagg, and first of all I'd like to thank the Missoula County Central Committee for putting this on, the College Republicans for helping. We're 78 days out from this election in the primary. The issue is, who can defeat John Tester, who in my opinion is just frankly out of touch with Montana. We'll talk about that some more. My name is Russ Fagg. I'm a fourth generation Montanan. I was a district court judge in Billings for 22 years, a Republican in the legislature prior to that. Been married for 26 years. Karen and I are blessed with twins, Harrison and Barkley, who are sophomores in college. I'm running because I'm afraid that my children, your children, and grandchildren will not have the opportunities that we have had to achieve the American dream. How can I do it? I've got the Montana roots, the Montana endorsements, and the Montana support behind me. I am here tonight to earn your support. My name is Russ Fagg, and thank you for being here.
All right, thank you very much. With that, we're going to go ahead and move into questions from the Central Committee. So Brad and Adam, if you wanted to go ahead and take it away. Our first answerer will be right here with Al, and then we'll just move down the table, same as we did with introductions.
Hopefully you can hear me in the back. First question for our panel. With the recent expansion of catastrophic forest fires in Montana, the consequences of which violate the state's constitutional guarantee of a healthy environment for its citizens, what is your plan regarding the National Forest Service to to open federal forest lands for the removal of fuels in an effort to create healthier forests and a healthier environment.
So as your next U.S. Senator, you know, my plan is to work with an overriding or a unifying theme. We need to work hard to reduce regulations that are preventing us from doing our jobs. As a physician, I can't do my job completely because I'm paying attention to the government. Same thing is happening in the U.S. Forest Service. In fact, they've developed a new culture that over the last 30 years is all about leaving the forest alone. But what we saw over the last 10 years is the fact that they won't even collaborate or coordinate with local authorities and the people that are on the ground and really know what we should do. So as your next U.S. Senator, my goal will be to bring the U.S. Forest Service back into working with the local authorities in collaboration, coordination, and we need to start working on management of our forests and not ignoring it. Thank you.
So that I have a safe ride home tonight, I forgot to introduce my wife. For 32 years, Jean Rosendale has joined me tonight as well. Thank you, dear. So I'm not hitchhiking. Okay, we have to address two things, the Endangered Species Act and the Equal Access to Justice laws. That is going to make a tremendous impact on what we can do with our federal lands. The Endangered Species Act has shut down the mining, it shut down the timber harvesting, and it is actually shutting down and threatening the very agricultural products that we produce in this state. We have to go in and rework the Endangered Species Act so that it's being utilized for the purposes that it was intended, and that's to keep in plants and animals from becoming extinct. The other thing we have to do is address the equal access to justice laws. The equal access to justice laws have enabled the different law firms around our nation to file lawsuits, frivolous lawsuits, and in simply an attempt to shut down the production of different products around the nation and certainly within our forest. So they have tied up these sales, and you all have seen the results of it. I was down here last summer in Lolo and watched as the fires raged and were destroying thousands and thousands of acres and really bringing unhealthy environment to everyone around. Endangered Species Act, the Equal Access to Justice laws will go a long way to freeing up the Forest Service so that they can actually do the good work that they want to, which is harvesting and properly managing those forests. Thank you.
Well, first of all, one of the big problems I have, you know, like I said, I'm not a politician, and big government scares me, and I think government's gotten bigger and gotten too deep into our lives and trying to make decisions for us on a local level when we need to have local input. And one of the big problems is we don't have local input. We need the Forest Service to be run on a professional level with input from the community because it's affecting all of us right here. I don't know about the rest of you, but I spent that entire last summer smoking 2 pine trees a day, and I don't want to do that again. And I agree with Matt on the equal access to justice. As a businessman, I've had to deal with litigation, and litigation is never good for anybody. And making it easier is not the way we need to go. We need to really start looking at what we can do about fixing the Equal Access to Justice Act so that we don't have environmental activists that don't have any skin in the game coming here and telling us what we can and cannot do with our forests. And I want to get back to something very simple. Multiple use sustained yield. We've got too many people have decided that multiple use means their use. And we need to start thinking about that multiple use. What does that mean? It means some places you need to protect. Some places you want timber permits. Some places you want mineral extraction. That's multiple use. And the second part of that, sustained yield, that implies that there's a yield, implies that you're taking something out. It doesn't mean let's just not touch our forests. It means let's manage them in a way that we can continue for multiple generations to continue to take product, timber, minerals, everything out of there. So to put it in a nutshell, the Forest Service, we need to have it run in a professional manner. We need to have local input on how that does. We need to go after the Equal Access to Justice Act so that people without skin in the game can't come and stop us from doing what we know that we need to do. And we need to just take that back and control it for us. They don't need to manage our forests just like we don't manage their subway system. Let's just get them out of here. Thank you. Yeah.
So I have loved being on the campaign trail, and recently I was up in Libby and Eureka, up in Lincoln County in the northwest part of the state. And what I learned was very frustrating to me. As a lifetime Montanan, we live in Montana because we want to have our young people, which is our absolute best resource, be able to stay here and make a living. And yet, in that county up in the northwest part of the state, 78% of the county is national forest. In 1970, there were a dozen sawmills in that county. Today, there are zero sawmills up there. That hurts us in a couple of ways. First of all, our young people who want to stay and have a good job and raise a family aren't able to do so. Second, we've got a forest that hasn't been properly and with stewardship principles logged in decades, which we know what that results in, all those forest fires. So it's a terrible loss of resources, first of our young people, and second of the timber itself. So what I propose to do is bring everybody together, the conservationists, the local citizens, the sportsmen, the industry people, and let's talk about what is a sustained practices way that we can utilize this resource for this generation and future generations. I absolutely believe we can do that. We're smart enough to do that. I agree with my colleagues to the left. The Endangered Species Act needs to be modernized. That is a big problem over there, and that's part of the solution. But wouldn't it be great if we could just get one sawmill going, and then maybe we could get two sawmills going, and put those young people to work that want to work, utilize this resource in a sustained way. We're Montanans, we're good stewards of the land, and we need to do that for future generations. Thank you.
So for our next question, Adam, go ahead, and then Matt, you will be answering first.
Yep.
What is your position on the Waters of the U.S. rule and the Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribe Water Compact?
Okay, water, and two separate water questions in 2 minutes. Waters of the U.S., I think, is a takings. It was clearly an attempt of a takings to control the water within the ranches and the farms of the nation. And when we start looking at turning over the regulation of dry creek beds and ponds and little streams to the federal government, we've got a major, major problem going on. So I'm glad that we've been removed from those issues currently. The Salish Kootenai Water Compact, we've had many discussions about over the last week or so. I was serving as the majority leader in the Montana Senate when that came before us. They had worked on it for many years, and I will tell you, I was not in favor of it, and I had many of my colleagues in the Senate that voted against it. It was the only water compact that had come before us that had not had nearly unanimous support across the legislature and get signed into law. It was very contentious. It had a lot of problems, specifically granted off-reservation water rights. It granted $55 million of taxpayer, Montana taxpayers' dollars to go and support it. Right now it's sitting in the federal government. They're looking at over $2 billion to implement this. It has just so many problems. It was granted immunity to the state in certain provisions, and yet the Constitution clearly states that there has to be a supermajority vote within the Montana legislature in order to grant immunity, and it was not. They took a simple majority vote on it. So with all of these problems, I could not support it at that time, and still to this time have problems with it and have concerns with it. I don't believe that we should sign off on legislation that is as good as we can get. We've got to make it right, and then we should support legislation. Thank you.
You have a bumper sticker on the back of my car. It says, whiskey's for drinking and water's for fighting. If you want to start a fight, let's just start talking about water. Going back to my background, like I said, I'm a businessman. Like I said before, one of the worst things you can do is get tied up in litigation. And this has been a very, the water rights issues are very litigious, very expensive. We've spent a lot of money fighting these issues, and we're going to continue fighting these issues. And all of us are going to be spending a lot of money if we don't come up with something. On the other hand, you know, I'm strict on the Constitution. If we've got constitutional issues about personal property rights, on what the federal government has the ability to do, what the states have the ability to do, we need to really understand what that means. I am not willing to deviate from the Constitution, because I think that one of the biggest problems we have is we've already deviated too far from the Constitution, and we need to stick to the black and white. Now, I know that we had a Supreme Court decision on this not too long ago, and there's a lot of talk about whether that was right, whether they're going to put something else out there. And I will say that if it comes down to the point where it is found to be constitutional, I think we need to get everybody together and do one round of figuring out what exactly needs to happen to make this imperfect compact better for everybody. We can't continue fighting this. We can't continue paying this money for it. But we've got really big issues that we need to talk about. We need to talk about the private property issues, the water rights issues, all the things that affect everybody. One of the things that scares me is if we lose, one of the fears that I hear across the state is losing losing the ability to irrigate. And if that is the net of what happens here, then we turn this state into a dust bowl. That's not good for anybody. But we need to come, get everybody to the table, continue talking about this, and try to come together. This is a very, very divisive issue. Thank you.
So a couple of my core values are states' rights, and let's look at the long-term consequences. The Compact Commission fits right into the states' rights. This was a process where everybody was at the negotiating table. The negotiations literally took over a decade. And at the end of the day, everybody knows that it's not a perfect settlement, but it's a settlement, and everybody at that table thought, this is the best that we can do. It was supported by the stock growers. It was supported by the grain growers. It passed the Montana legislature. It was signed by the governor. The Compact Commission process really works. We are so fortunate in Montana that we have that process. We're one of the few states that have decided water issues in that fashion rather than going through litigation. I was a judge for 22 years. I understand how litigious things can get, how much it can cost. If this compact doesn't go through, it would go back to the court system. It would take decades. It would take millions of dollars of attorney's fees and expert witness fees. I think that would be very detrimental to Montanans. And at the end of the day, the result very well could be worse than we have right now. So I know there's a lot of consternation over the water compact, and I would not support Senator Tester's bill. I think it's prohibitively expensive. However, I like the process, and I think we need to be very serious about the good that that process brings to Montana citizens.
You know, I absolutely disagree. You know, both, the only difference between the waters of the United States and this issue of the CSKT Water Compact is who is doing the taking. The WOTUS is by the federal government, and the CSKT is by the tribes and the state. Because I'll tell you, let's drive it right down what happened in 2015. What we had was we had a process. Sure, what happened is the rules of the legislature were broken. They were overruled, and they were thrown out by a simple majority. It's called the law of the jungle. So when we say this was a good process in legislature 15, it wasn't. We were superseded. What about the water compact? Okay, there were people at the table, but I'll tell you what, Western Montana was on the table. We were divided up and given up to try to prevent water rights being taken in Eastern Montana. That's wrong. So let me tell you, both of these are a taking of property rights. It's plunder without due process or without remuneration or reimbursement, and that's wrong. Judge says we're gonna be in court. You know what, in Western Montana, I want my day in court. I want due process for my water rights. My grandparents fought for their water rights in Judith Basin. My other grandparents fought for their water rights in Blaine County. And you know what, if you have rights, every generation is gonna have to fight for them. It'll never be a done deal. Thank you.
Guns have been a hot topic in our national dialogue as of late. What is your position on the Second Amendment as it pertains to semi-automatic weapons? And do you believe that keeping firearms out of the hands of law-abiding citizens will reduce gun crime? Please explain.
Thank you. Obviously, one of the things that we saw happen very recently was that March on Washington. That day, I took a bunch of friends and supporters, and one of my friends brought his daughter out to the gun range. So we had our own little little time out there. And I got to do a little aside. I only got 2 minutes, but this is just a great story. So one of my friends' 10-year-old daughter, Abby's there, and dad's working with his daughter shooting the 12 gauge, and she's, you know, enjoying it. And afterwards, Abby comes up to me and says, "You know what? I was Greg Gianforte's secret weapon." I said, "Really?" She says, "Yeah, I prayed for him every day of his campaign, and he won." She says, "I'm going to be your secret weapon next." So, but anyway, to get straight to it, you know, one of the things that really frustrates me is when you hear the argument about why do you need that for hunting? Why do you need that for target shooting? Why do you need a removable magazine? When you start hearing this stuff, why do you need a semi-automatic? You don't need that for shooting deer. Well, no, you don't. And hunting is a big part of my life, and preserving hunting culture is something that I've spent my entire life doing. You know, I'm a member of a lot of advocacy groups, and it's something that I enjoy. But the Second Amendment is not about hunting, and it's not about target practice. The Second Amendment is about your God-given right to protect yourself and to stand up against tyranny. And that has nothing to do with semi-automatic or whether it's a hunting rifle or what kind of magazine it has. We have our God-given right to protect ourselves, and that Second Amendment is what keeps us away from an oppressive government, and I am not willing to bow on that at all, ever. Just want to be very clear about that. That's something that's very important to me. I'm sure it's important to a lot of people in this room. The Second Amendment is something that I will always fight for. It's something that I believe in. If you're willing to deviate from the Second Amendment, from the Constitution, what else are you willing to give up? Me? Nothing. Thanks.
So let's start at the foundation, which is the Constitution. The Second Amendment very clearly says, shall not be infringed. To me, as a judge of 22 years, that's very clear. The problem that we are having across America is much deeper than a band-aid approach of more regulations or banning certain weapons. It's a sociological problem and it's a mental health issue. I've seen it in my court for many years. How many times have I had a person come in for an order of protection and they have the order of protection and they'll say, "Well, now I'm safe," right? And I'll say, "No. This is a piece of paper, doesn't mean you're safe. You still have to be on your guard." And so the problem is, criminals do not pay attention to laws or regulations. Many of these offenses in schools, for instance, happen in gun-free zones. There aren't supposed to be any guns in there, of course, but we know what happens, and tragedy happens. And so I read that the average 18-year-old American male has seen 15,000 murders on television, his PlayStation, his Game Boy, by the time he turns 18. You add that with a little bit of element of a mental health issue, and anger and frustration with society and teenage angst, and we know that bad things can happen. So the problem goes much deeper than any sort of regulations are going to, and that goes to the family. We all know the struggles that we have in America with families, with single parent families, and the issues that are going on. That is hard to get your arms around, but that's where we need to go. We need to go to the heart of the problem and not have some sort of a band-aid approach. As a judge for 22 years, I know that that doesn't work. Thank you.
Yes, the Second Amendment should not be and will not be infringed As your next U.S. Senator, I will fight for that. You know, I'm a physician. I'm an Air Force veteran. In 1995, almost 23 years ago, I was an early medical responder to the Oklahoma City bombing. 168 people died. 19 children died as preschoolers. Was it guns? Was it a semi-automatic weapon? No. It was fertilizer and diesel fuel. You know, it's not the weapon that causes the evil. It's the person that has the evil inside it that causes the problem. So let us not make the weapon evil. You know, we have laws right now that if a person is that may harm themselves or is a threat to the community can be involuntarily committed. We need to use those rules and we need to use those laws. Take the person off the street, figure out if they are truly of harm to themselves, and if they are a harm to themselves or the community, then take away their rights through due process. As your next U.S. Senator, what we're going to do is we're going to, A, make sure that the government and the bureaucracy does their job, because many of these things wouldn't have happened if they would have done their fiduciary duty and put that data in the background check. We wouldn't be here for a number of these issues. Number two, as your U.S. Senator, I will make sure that if there's money going to schools, there'll be block grants that allow schools to harden their schools and protect our children. And finally, as your U.S. Senator, I will make sure the federal government stays out of the way so your local school districts can decide whether or not staff and teachers should bear arms. Because I'll tell you, in Custer County, Montana, they've been doing it for 4 years and they've been successful. Thank you.
I'm sure most of the people in this room have read the Constitution, and certainly the Bill of Rights. And our founders used the most eloquent language on many of those parts. They used the most simple language they could possibly develop to protect our Second Amendment rights. Shall not be infringed. That is really, really a basic concept. I'm a lifetime member of the NRA. I have carried legislation for the Montana Shooting Sports Association to protect your Second Amendment rights, and I've been endorsed now and in the past by the Gun Owners of America organization. I will fight for your Second Amendment rights because I do not believe that taking one person's rights away to try and protect someone else is the way to do this. We've got laws on the books, and we have plainly seen that they have not been protecting us. So what we have to do is go to where the problem is. Every one of these incidences that we've seen, these horrific incidences where people, innocent victims, lives have been lost, always contain two elements. They're gun-free zones and there's mental illness. Last legislative session, I directed my staff to start working on mental illness. So if you look at the statute now here in Montana, mental illness gets treated with the same parity that physical conditions do. That's where we have to begin. Go to the root of the problem. If we don't go to the root of the problem, it's like trying to fight a forest fire over in Glendive that actually started here in Lolo, trying to put the smoke out. Let's go to where the fire is. We've got to go and address the mental illness issues that are across this nation and then start looking around and deciding whether these gun-free zones are working. I personally do not believe that they are, and I believe that we should remove the barriers that are in place to allow school districts to develop the security systems that they think are best for their specific districts. Thank you.
The VA runs a single-payer healthcare system that has been an epic failure. What are some specific reforms you'd bring forth as a U.S. Senator to fix the failed system and aid our veterans who are being deprived of the services they have earned and deserve?
You know, that Senator Tester's a big, big issue, and he's talked about it for a decade. I've talked to over 100 veterans on the trail as I go across the state, and almost all of them universally say, I am worse off or the same as when Senator Tester took office. And so his big issue has really fallen flat for our veterans, those people that deserve the best that America can give them. I agree, the system has failed the veterans. I would like to move into a choice and competition system. I like the Veterans Choice Program, but it's been poorly run, it's been poorly funded, it's been poorly administered. I like that idea though, where veterans can go to their local care unit, hospital, clinic, wherever they might live, and have their needs taken care of. And I believe the veterans with, you know, Montana has more veterans per capita than any state in the United States. And I believe if the VA went to Missoula Community Hospital and said, listen, we want to negotiate with you, and if the veterans come to you, will you be able to give us a better rate? And I think they would, because they want that business. And so choice and competition is the key to this. Marketplace systems we have to put in place, like health savings accounts, and those can also apply to veterans. Maybe the government even would give them a start on a health savings account. Patients have to have some skin in the game, the veterans want to have some skin in the game. And at the end of the day, we are smart enough that we can make this system work but we need to do it properly and think of the veterans first. We have to do it in an efficient way, and I believe that we have the ability to do that, to do this right for the veterans and the American people.
Again, I'm a U.S. veteran. I'm also a military physician, and I've worked in the Audie Murphy VA system in San Antonio, Texas. First of all and foremost, what we have to do is we have to change the culture. Because I'm going to call a spade a spade. What's going on is that the culture, the bureaucracy, it's more important for them to take care of themselves than it is to take care of our vets. And I've watched it. When I've tried to do work and try to work as hard as I could as a doctor, I was told, Dr. Olszewski, slow down. Because if you don't slow down and go our speed, we'll go even slower. I have a person who's a rheumatologist at the VA. He came in one day and he had no patients. His clinic schedule was filled with patients. They had all expired and they were placed in by the bureaucracy so they get an afternoon off on a summer Friday afternoon. That's got to change. Number two, we need to refocus the mission of the VA. The VA needs to be the best provider for service-related disabilities. If you have PTSD, you should get the best care through the VA, and there's no place that's better. If you are a double amputee or worse, or have spinal injuries, you should be able to get your care through the VA, and it should be the leading foremost authority in that area. And if it's not service-related, we need to take and refocus those services and bring them back into the private system where they will get their bread and butter care just like us in every system. And finally, for Montana, we're going to take care of our vets in the rural areas and the frontier areas. And my plan is to work with federally qualified health centers, and we're going to combine those systems that are already in place and working for our poor and in these areas to not only work with VA, but also with the Indian Health Service. And that's how we're going to make healthcare better for our vets and for Montana.
It's very simple. Accountability, leadership, and administration. It all boils down to that. We've seen millions and billions of dollars that have been spent on the Veterans Administration. We see new buildings being constructed, and we're not seeing them staffed properly. We see bad actors that are participating, trying to deliver services to our veterans, and they are not doing it, and they continue to stay in those same positions. If those folks were located in the private sector, they'd been out of jobs a long time ago. All of these things boil down to accountability, leadership, and administration. We've got to replace the bad actors. We have got to eliminate the duplication of efforts and allow the veterans to go into the private facilities and receive their procedures. And then we need to shorten the time period with which we replace the vacancies. Right now, if you talk to the Veterans Administration, it takes nearly a year to get a physician in place when a position opens up. That is absolutely asinine. When you go into the private sector, you can have something like that turned around, even with an extensive interview period, 30 days, you can get a highly qualified individual. I've gone in and watched and met with the veterans and listened to town halls and listened to the complaints, and they are not getting the services that they deserve. And then when I look in the newspaper, for example, Fort Harrison was rated at 2 stars. And anybody who knows anything about the star rating system, you go to a hotel, it's a 5-star rating, you're staying in a pretty decent place. 4, we can put up with. 3, you know, you're passing through. 2 stars is not really that good. Fort Harrison was rated at 2 stars in 2016. In 2017, when the ratings came out, they dropped to 1-star approval. And the spokesperson came out and said, just because our rating went down does not mean that we have a problem. That's the problem.
All right, the biggest problem is we're just sending too many career politicians to D.C. to solve problems that they don't understand. We need to stop sending career politicians trying to solve problems they don't understand. The VA has been a disaster, and I just want to talk a little bit about the stats. I mean, we've got, Russ had mentioned this, one of the highest veteran populations per capita in the state of Montana. We've also got one of the highest rates of veteran suicide. I saw a stat very recently that I think it was 550 plus or minus veteran suicide since John Tester's been in office. We also have a big problem with veteran unemployment. Bureau of Labor Statistics says we have one of the highest levels of veteran unemployment. With a veteran experience in this state is embarrassing. And we need to take care of those that we are sending to protect this great nation. I'm also a combat veteran. I'm very connected with the veteran community in this state. When I first was honorably discharged, you know, I joined the Montana Veterans of Foreign Wars, and I'm very active in my post. And I hear these stories. One of the members of my post was telling me a story about how he needed an eye exam, and somebody thought that it made sense to send him to San Francisco to get this exam. And again, as a businessman, this is showing me that people in government programs are run like government programs, and that's the biggest problem. We need to stop running them like government programs. Who thinks that sending somebody for a $50 exam to San Francisco and spending I don't know how many thousands of dollars in hotel rooms and miles to get them there makes sense? You know, I came from the private sector first. I was a businessman. I built companies. I went into the Air Force after September 11th. That was my first exposure to how this was run. And I was just shocked that there was no accountability. And that comes down to it. We need accountability. We need to deal with problems. Like, I was just looking in Missoula before I came here. 5,000 plus veterans waiting for appointments right now with two doctors. Think about it. We need accountability.
Thank you.
Next question. Yeah. I want it. Bring it on. Bring it on. With the national debt at over $21 trillion, what proactive steps would you propose to get the deficit under control and position the federal government to begin paying down the debt? Please provide specific examples if you can.
Thank you. Number one, I do support the Trump tax cuts. You know what that did is that's our money. It's gonna bring back $570 million into your pockets, and that'll be for every year. It's the biggest economic stimulus program this state has ever seen. And you know what, with that, I expect that the GDP, if that happens in every state, that it's gonna go from an anemic 1.7%, and we want it to be 3, 4, 5% if we can. For every 1% of the GDP that goes up, we get $3 trillion in revenue. That's a big deal, all right? So we need to balance our issues with bringing up our productivity and our revenue, but we also have to control our spending. So everything, welfare, we've become a welfare state. Let's just call it what it is. We are a welfare country, and we're gonna have to reform it, and we're gonna have to bring in those costs, and we're gonna have to find a way to cap them, and we're gonna have to work it. Now, we have to then, once we have our balanced budget, we have to talk about $21 trillion in debt. And you know what? We're gonna have to, all of us are gonna have to have a shared sense of sacrifice, just like the great generation did in World War II. And we're all gonna have to take and give a little. And if that means that if you're getting your care or you're getting entitlements and welfare, you're gonna have to probably take a little less. And those of us that are working are gonna probably have to pay a little bit more. But if I pay more taxes, I want to make sure it's going to bring down that $21 trillion. Because if I'm going to do it, we're going to have to do it for several generations. But that's how we do it.
I'm cheap, and I'm proud of it. I started cutting the budget in 2010, as soon as I was elected to the legislature. I started serving on finance and claims, and went through and analyzed the state's budget line by line and brought tens of millions of dollars worth of reductions forward so that the legislature could review it. And some of those they took on and cut out of the budget, and some of them they did not. That's just the way the process works. We have got to reduce our spending. Right now, with the tax reform legislation just went through, they're estimating that we're going to generate record amounts of revenue, $3.4 trillion, quite frankly, for the whole nation, $3.4 trillion, record, new high record. The problem is, we're going to spend $4.2 trillion. There's the problem. We are spending far too much. And it is going to take individuals who are willing to go in there and look at the budget and the departments and the agencies and go through them and scrutinize them line by line the way that I have consistently done in the past and cut spending. I reduced the operating cost in my agency by 23% in the last year. And I will bet you that you can talk to any other elected official at the county level or at the state level or at the federal level and say, how much did you reduce your spending by last year? And they won't be able to tell you it was 23%. If every department head in the state of Montana had done that last year, we would not have had a special session. And these gentlemen would have been able to stay home an extra couple of months or a couple of days in the fall without having to go through that battle. That's what it takes to bring our deficit down, and that's the kind of work that I've done in the past and will continue to do in the future. Thank you.
I'm a businessman. I look at this from a business point of view. And in my business, well, one of the businesses I've been involved in is buying cash flow real estate. And when you buy this real estate, you model exactly what it's going to look like. You know what your expenses are going to be, what your income is going to be, and you model that so you have expectations on what to do. And you live within that budget when you do model that. And we're not doing that in government. And what I do in my business is every single month I have a conference call with all of my property managers to see if we're in or out of that budget to make sure that we're sticking it. We talk about the problems, what worked, what didn't, how we keep in our budget. We need to, first of all, stop the leaking. We need to balance the budget. And I know there's a lot of talk about balanced budget amendments. We need to talk about that really seriously. But the 800-pound gorilla or the elephant in the room is that $20 trillion. $20 trillion. A lot of people can't even conceive of how much that is. It's such a huge amount of money that if you did, first of all, we've got a spending problem and we need to reduce that. And I think everybody here is going to agree with that. We're spending way too much money. And I talked about government programs being run like government programs. There's a lot of waste. We need to start running those like private sector companies that have accountability. And if you're not performing, I'm sorry, you get fired and you start cutting those expenses down. So that's only part of it. Because that $20 trillion is so big, that's not going to fix it. If you start just slashing government programs, like they talk about cutting, you know, military spending, that's not going to do it. A lot of people don't understand how big this is. So you'll hear, we need to increase taxes. No, you don't. Taxes would not do it. If you did a confiscatory tax on everybody in America, you still wouldn't put a dent in it. So we need to do two things. First of all, we need to balance the budget. We need to make sure we're not adding to it. The second thing is we need to cut spending every place that we can cut spending and still maintain what is America and protect this great nation. As a combat veteran, that's very, very important to me. And then finally, we need to create economic prosperity so that we can start floating the boats and make up that difference, because the government is getting too intrusive in our lives and we need to succeed in our businesses. Thank you.
In my opinion, this is the question of the night. President Dwight Eisenhower said, "We cannot be strong if we go broke." The reason I'm running is because I think the budget deficit is the single biggest problem facing America. So as George Will said, if you're in a hole, stop digging. Maybe this is too simple, but I know in my household and your household, if you don't have enough money, you stop spending beyond what you have. You only spend what you bring in. So my proposal is this. First of all, I support wholeheartedly the balanced budget amendment, and I proposed it when I was in the Montana legislature. And second, we're in 2018. So when the 2019 budget rolls out, we say we're going to cap it at 2018 levels. We're going to have exactly the same budget as we did in 2018. If we do that and have 3 to 3.5% growth, we'll have a balanced budget in about 3 years. Now, everybody's going to have to pull in a notch on their belt, but if everybody gives, we can make this work. We all know, as citizens of this country, that there is waste in government. We know that to be true. I believe in my heart, if we tell the program administrators, listen, you have to live within 2017 numbers, they're going to have to do it, and they're going to be able to do it. And we have to do that for our kids, because I'm afraid we're going to implode as a nation from within if we don't get our hands around this debt. I don't know what happens when the greatest country in the world goes bankrupt. We are the greatest country that the world has ever seen. But as Alex de Tocqueville said in Democracy in America, every democracy eventually fails because people get reelected by taking money out of the public treasury. And that's precisely what's happening in the United States. And John Tester is a part of it. Just recently, he supported the omnibus bill, which was a budget buster. Senator Daines, Congressman Gianforte voted against it. Balanced budget, live within our means.